Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the ninth in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we're going to be talking about religion and politics. And with us is Ron Rucker, Greg Jones, and Todd Pace. My first question. Until the late into the 18th century, most nations in the Christian and Muslim worlds had an official national religion. Since that time, some nations have gone more secular, while others have maintained that their citizens practice the state religion or face punitive consequences. What are your thoughts on state-mandated religions? Anybody want to take that up first? State-mandated religions. Okay, Greg.
Okay, well, state-mandated religions, I think that's sort of like an oxymoron because you can't force anyone to practice a religion. So only if, the majority of the people of that country follow a particular religion, do I think that it can be, willingly, if they willingly follow that religion, it can be considered as a majority state religion, but not by force.
A good example is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a state mandated religion, and people who don't follow that sometimes can be, thrown off buildings or things like that. So you're saying that's not a good thing, because the majority of the people are Muslim in Saudi Arabia, and it could be that the majority of the people do believe in that state mandated religion.
Yes, but unfortunately, it's not a democratic country, and the people have not chosen those leaders. So they may be following the faith through tradition, but then I think that if people do want to be a Christian there, they may have to hide their faith. I don't approve of that. Mm-hmm. I don't approve of that. I think it's illegitimate.
Okay. Todd, you have any thoughts on state-mandated?
I would agree with this. We are very fortunate to live in the United States where built into our Constitution is the freedom to practice our religion to the dictates of our own conscience. And we reserve the right for all men to practice those same, to have those same rights, and that we respect each other with that. I think that allows us to have the individual freedoms and respect each other on the things that we differ. Unfortunately, there are governments around the world that mandate that religion, and you only have to look in the news in the past month or so where that has been disregarded and people's religious beliefs are sacrificed on the altar of the rights of others. And so that probably doesn't jive with anybody's beliefs.
What
regardless.
Examples? What do you mean? Recently?
If you look at Egypt in the past few weeks, there was people that their churches were burned out. Our country is not... It doesn't have a completely clean slate on that either. We look at there was a church just I'm blanking on the name of where that was at, but just recently somewhere in the South where a madman went into a church and shot up a whole congregation.
Yeah, it was Texas, I think.
So, but that that wasn't state-sponsored limitations as it is in some other places.
What do you think?
Well, for starters, I think Greg hit a good point. Is at least typically, maybe not entirely now, but at least typically, state-sponsored religions start in countries that are not democratic. They're dictatorships, and so or kingships or whatever, and so people aren't elected. You just grow into it, and somebody has the authority to say that's the religion we're going to go with. And so, you know, and I think that's what happened with the folks who came to the United States, is they didn't like that. And so we have some kind of constitutional protection there to allow us to do that. But I think Greg really hit it on the head that there's a difference between democracies and the other countries where typically your state-sponsored religions.
So more democracy generally means, in your mind, that there is more secular options, that you're allowed to choose religions and not be forced into a particular religion because of the democratic aspect of it. Go ahead, Greg.
I'd like to make a point. I know there was a couple of incidents in Egypt where churches were attacked, but in both of those cases, the police were posted outside. And I think one or two of those police officers died trying to defend the Christian church. And also in another case where some of the citizens, the Muslim citizens, died defending the church. So I don't think Egypt has such a policy of, you know, forcing the religion on anybody. I understand that people are able to practice their faith there.
So there were Muslims that actually suffered their defense of the Christians in Egypt at that time. Okay, the religions represented here today, and we're talking about the Lutherans, Islam, and the Mormons, seem to have a male-dominated hierarchical organizational structure, with women generally pretty low in the pecking order of authority. Is this tradition healthy? And would you like to see more influence from women in your particular faith?
Well, for starters, I think I'll take exception for the Lutherans, at least the Lutheran I am. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, the presiding bishop for our denomination in the United States is a female.
I stand corrected.
The bishop for the Alaska Synod is a female. We have lots of female pastors. We have lots of female bishops and higher members in the structure of the ELCA. So now, that may not translate, it does not translate very well into the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church. It doesn't translate to the Wisconsin Synod. They would be, for lack of a better term, more conservative and less and more male-oriented and less female-oriented.
So as a representative of a organization that is pretty pro-women, so to speak, do you think that is good for your faith?
I think it's great, and we're moving more and more. It's one of the things I like about the ELCA. It's a part of the function of that attracted me to the ELCA. I have to be honest. When I moved to Wasilla in 1980, there wasn't a Methodist church, and I was Methodist, but so I had to become a Lutheran by default. But I wouldn't ever go back now. And I'm actually studying. I'm three classes away from becoming a Lutheran pastor. By the time I finish, I'll be 68. but I think we have an idea, and I think it comes from Luther in his writings and his ideas and the shapers of the Reformation, that all comes in. That, you know, the Bible says there is no Jew or Gentile, no male, female. And so we as a denomination of the ELCA is really pushing to be diverse and to be inclusive.
And allow women to be high in the power authority. Greg, what do you think about that?
Okay, well.
First of all, my assessment, my initial, you know, was contradicted by Ron in his religion. Am I correct in assessing that with Islam, that it is sort of male hierarchical?
Well, what you have is, I think the true tenets of Islam strive to honor women to the highest degree. We're talking about back to Virgin Mary is highly regarded. There's a chapter of the Holy Quran, Maryam, which honors her and gives all the respect and praise and blessing for her. And then we have she's one of the four perfect women recognized in Islam. We have the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, his wife, Khadija, and his daughter Fatima are considered among perfect women. Also, the fourth perfect woman, her name is, in Islam, her name is Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh. And so these women are honored for their piety, their knowledge, their faith. Even the wife of Pharaoh, you know, though she may have been married to a tyrant, she kept her faith. And so now their status in society, women in Islam are permitted to hold high positions of authority, you know, and it's particularly here in America. And in some governments around the world, you'll see women in the parliament and places like that. Now, I honestly believe that there's just some type of the nature of men to suppress women. So there's that struggle, that natural struggle between the higher goals of faith and the lower inclinations of men. But Islam seeks to elevate the status of women. And so that's something that in our modern time, we need to publicize that more and revive that.
Well, how about imams? Could there be a female imam in your religion?
Well, now, religiously speaking, this in biblical history, I don't know of any woman who was ever a prophet, but there are women in the Bible and the Holy Quran who were, like I said, the Virgin Mary and others who are highly regarded, but not as the patriarch, you know. So, and that's not, I don't think that's divine choice.
So do you see a pathway for women in Islam ever to become spiritual leaders like an imam is? Or is that tradition going to be one that keeps that from happening?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. And now you have different branches of Islam, of course, just like you have different branches of Christianity. Now, I know that in Islam, they have what they call sheikhs, a sheikh. You know, sheikh is the male term. Sheikha is the female term, which is a spiritual leader. Mm-hmm. They have them. You can. That's something that the listeners can look up, the sheikhs. And I know of some. I know of some who I respect highly. And that's something that needs to be publicized. You know, I think Islam in America and in the West, you know, it's sort of behind the curve on really getting the message out there. I think we've been by the media and some of the events of recent history have just sort of given a cloudy picture of Islam. So now in the past 10 or 20 years, I think we've made some progress. But here in America, there are Muslim women who are leaders of some prominent organizations right here in America.
Todd, what about the Mormon?
We believe that we are divine children of a heavenly father, and that he has, as we come to earth, we are invested as male and female with divine nature and potential, and that we have divine abilities to do different things, but those roles are different. Our church is organized with a male leadership. However, the females in our church have their own organization with their own president and working in councils together with the men. Those decisions are made. Being in one of those councils, we always. In fact, I'd be afraid to make decisions without counseling with my Relief Society president, because they bring insights into decisions that I don't possess. We believe that males are primarily one of their primary responsibilities is to love and nurture their family jointly with their spouse, with their wife. But the male's primary responsibility is to be a provider for that family. And the woman has the primary responsibility for raising and nurturing those children. And I don't think you'd have any question with any of us that our wives have, call it whatever you want, a gene, an ability to do that much better than I would ever consider myself being able to do.
Yeah, we certainly have a division of labor in our family, too. She does things much better than I do some things well.
And so. Right. And there's things that, as a male, that I can do differently or better. But we counsel together and we work together to make those things happen, both as a family and in a church organization. We both have defined roles. I think the only time there's any friction with that is when, coming back to your first question, is when governments of the earth try to dictate to our religious abilities what we should believe and what we shouldn't believe, and try to influence how those beliefs should be instituted and run. I think the only time we get in trouble is when the governments of the earth tell anybody in this room how we should think and how we should act and how we should govern ourselves.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. This is Bridging the Gap. We're discussing many of the issues that divide us politically today. The discussion is about religion and politics. We are seeking solutions here through dialogue. And my next question to the panel is, currently the most notorious example of religion and politics is the candidacy of Roy Moore for the Senate from Alabama. His campaign seemed to be based on the belief that his religious convictions trumped everything else. How does that notion of Roy Moore aligning himself with God and the religion, how does that sit with y'all?
Well, in terms of the ALCA and me, not very well. In fact, I recently I saw a Facebook post that said something to the effect, it doesn't matter how many times you attend church, it matters how you treat people. To me, there's a disconnect in our society right now about that. And I think,
is it a religious disconnect, or is just the how you treat people is a more cultural, social thing?
No, I think there's a religious connotation there. I want to be careful how I say this, but the ilk of the Roy Moores of the world say, I've been saved, I'm a child of God, and it doesn't matter how I treat people. And we in the ELCA say, you know, Jesus Christ was about grace, and so how you treat people, how he treated people, is what it's really all about. And it's not about... There is nothing, when we talk grace, we say there is nothing we can do to earn God's grace. Jesus did it for us. But once we understand the grace, we have a responsibility to treat the world around us with that same grace, to be respectful and supportive to everybody, not to be judgmental. So I'm trying hard not to be judgmental of Roy Moore.
But the people who supported him due to the fact that he was so aligned with religion.
Yeah.
Greg, what do you think about Roy Moore?
Well, I thank God that he did not win. And
let's give the voters of Alabama a little bit of
here. Yeah. And so, you know, even with the current political climate that we're living in and all the things that are happening, the sexual assault of women that's coming out. And I really thank God that it's sort of coming out so that we can so that we can address it. And I think this thing with Roy Moore shows that we still got work to do. We have to sort of maintain the lawn. You know, you can't just cut the grass once. You gotta keep cutting it. So I think that we have to be vigilant and keeping everything moving forward.
Little promotional segue here. Our next show is going to be about the Me Too movement and sexual assault and sexual harassment. So if you like what Greg said, tune in next time. Todd, what do you think about that?
You know, I followed this Moore story, and the feelings are extremely strong across the nation of that because it's become a national issue. And where does the truth lie on the Roy Moore issue? Truthfully, I don't know. Either Roy Moore is fabricating that he was innocent of all the charges that were leveled against him, or those allegations are true. And there's clearly huge forces on both sides of that that aligned to promote their own story. At the last count I saw in that forces outside of the state of Alabama had contributed $30 million to promote that story that he had dated teenage girls 35 years ago. Whether that story is true or not, or that's just political hay that people have made, I don't know. I'm not sure I know the truth of that, and I followed that back and forth, and I'm not sure anybody will know the answer to that because no one seemed to have come up with a definitive answer. Fortunately, in our system, the voters of Alabama were able to decide that, and they will have a senator that will take those values, their values, forward, and if they dislike the values that go forward, they'll in 6 years they can reelect a new leader. That's the beauty of our system.
Yep.
Has the evangelical Christian movement been hijacked by conservative politics?
You say that again?
Has the evangelical Christian movement been hijacked by conservative politics?
No.
No.
Why are you looking at me?
I think I gave everybody an eyeball here. But, feel guilty about something I asked?
The men in this room, the one thing that we share is probably somewhat conservative views on politics. We may not agree on everything, but political forces would love to have us as a voting bloc carrying their water for them. But we are individuals and we have independent minds, and through our thoughts and study and our prayers, we come to independent conclusions. And although many times our thoughts and minds aligned on that, I don't think that we're driven by any political force or political party.
You're talking about the individuals in the room.
I would say as a nation. I think that as a nation, I don't think you could come out and say that based on your religion, you belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or the Progressive Party or the Socialist Party or the Communist Party. Because of our religious backgrounds, the one thing that we have together that brings us together are those that we have, that we are divine in nature. We are divine beings with divine potential, and And so we have a power in our belief in God that brings us together, and so we tend to allow the morals that are brought to us from our belief in God that tends to make us want to vote for people that have those same morals.
Greg?
Well, I think there's been quite a struggle. You said, has the evangelical movement hijacked the conservative?
That's the question.
Yeah.
Has the conservative politics hijacked the evangelical Christians?
I would say that I don't think so. I think, people are still, they haven't made final decisions. I think there's still a lot of debate going on about where people stand. Things have just been coming out daily, practically daily, so people have to look within themselves to see, are they going to support the statements that are being made, the allegations that are coming out? And I think good people are making a decision, not to support these things. So I don't think it's been hijacked. I think the goodness in people is going to come out.
Ron, are you recovered from your initial guilt panic attack over there?
I guess for me, my thought process on this is it's almost a which came first, the chicken or the egg. I do think there is, as Todd said, in every political element, different religious elements, and vice versa. In every religious element, there are people of different political persuasions, and that is correct. But I do believe that there is something politically and religious happening in the conservative realm, but I'm not sure which one's hijacking the other. I can't discern that. I think something's going on. I'm just not quite sure that I've been able to figure out exactly what it is.
Mike just slipped me this question here that is relevant to as a follow-up to what I just asked. And it is, does the media overhype the issue? And does the social media magnify the differences?
Oh, absolutely. And, I harp on this all the time about the impact of the changes in our society. And we're all a little older. We probably remember when there was only three news. Thanks. There was only three news channels, and you had maybe two people on each of those channels.
If your antenna worked well enough,
yeah,
you got all three.
Now you've got 1,000 news channels and 1,000 people on each one, and then you've got it in sports, and it's everywhere, and we are inundated with information, and information isn't being filtered at all anymore. It's just flying, and the social media really makes it fly. And you can put anything out there, whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent. And, I like that. I'm going to stay right with that, and I'm sending it right back out. And so somebody sends out a little piece of fake news, and now it's the big thing of the day. So I think, is it... The question then comes back to the same thing. Is it our societal thirst for this information that's feeding the animal, or is the media's thirst feeding society? I am back to that.
That's
which came first, the chicken or the egg? Because I don't know which way it's real. What's really driving
that
the train?
Todd, the chicken or the egg?
I would agree. Growing up, we had three channels, and Walter Cronkite would come on. And
Huntley and Brinkley on the other station.
And the other channels were telling you the same story, but it was more of them coming on and telling you, this are the day's events of what's happened. What has changed with the media is each one of those channels now, instead of coming on and reporting the facts and letting you decide, it has a panel of talking heads that are trying to influence how you should see those. things. And so rather than reporting the events of the day, they're twisting and spinning the events of the day for a political purpose.
Yep.
Our country is founded so that we'd have freedom of the press, but that separation between freedom and press and politicians has – that line has blurred significantly, where they are anymore are a political arm of those – of politics.
Yep.
And it's gone way beyond that. If you look at the social medias of Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and you name them, not only are they not telling you the facts or of what happened today, but they're telling you how you should think about those facts, and the facts that they don't want you to have are being pre-filtered out. We're seeing that in the news just this week, where the facts that they don't want us to see or don't want us to bring back into those social media atmospheres are actually being filtered out because the founders of those social media sites don't like them. So the media has changed quite dramatically. I don't think it's changed our views on things, but it makes it a little more difficult to determine where that truth lies.
Greg?
Yeah.
Social media magnifying the situation, overemphasizing it?
Well, social media, actually, I think social media has done a lot to help the common people because, you know, if you follow just the, like some of the major news networks that have, like you said, been accused of sensationalizing or even promoting fake news in some cases, you know, when you have a network of people, if you're really an activist or something like that and you're sort of spreading the word through your social media network, you know, like what happened, the people who occupied Wall Street or some of these people are, you know, they're using social media to sort of go around the fake news and sort of spread the word on their own.
Well, the Arab Spring was highly connected with the social media.
Yeah.
But that didn't work out so well in a lot of countries.
The Arab Spring didn't. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I got some friends in Egypt. And this is an important point because they're studying over there. And so we would see the images on the news of the violence and the, you know, you hear the machine gun in the background mowing the people down. And so we asked them, is it like bad over there? They said, that's just downtown. The people are demonstrating, you know, but they were out in the neighborhoods and they were living their normal lives. So it was nothing like what we saw and heard on the news. I mean, I have friends over there, and I think that's the case in a lot of places where the news is manipulated. And, you know, if we have a network of people that we can sort of find out what's really going on.
So you see more advantages to social media than the actual negativity?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, because, you're able to sort of, you're building a grassroots sources. I think that's it's a growing strength.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We're at 89.7 on your radio dial in Palmer, Wasilla. 89.5 in the Sutton area, and 91.5 out in Glacier View. This is Bridging the Gap. We're discussing religion and politics with Ron Rucker, Greg Jones, and Todd Pace. So my next question is, in the 50s and 60s and even today, the civil rights movement was led by certified ministers such as Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and now today, Bishop William Barber. Has the marriage of religion and civil rights advanced society in general?
I think it has. I've studied civil rights. I was sort of a child in the 60s. You know, I was born in 66, so I'm just sort of coming of age. But, I think...
So Malcolm was already dead when you were born, and Martin was killed 2 years later.
Exactly, yeah. So, but I've studied it, and, of course, my family and everything. Calling people to account, and this was in the case with Dr. Martin Luther King as a Christian.
As a certified minister.
Yeah, a certified minister. Calling people to Christian principles and values who also claim to be Christian, whether they're, even the KKK claims to be Christian. But, you know, you have extremists on all sides. But I think the fact that they were able to call them to account to what's in the Bible.
Through the Christian message.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I think that was very effective. And I think it's helped society, yes. I think give us a moral foundation.
That's the question. Mm-hmm. Those guys help society by being affiliated with their religions, by being certified ministers?
I think so. But on the other hand, I'm excited to see others involved. And in my mind, I'm looking at two other types. So everybody you referenced were really black ministers mm-hmm. involved in civil rights.
Right.
Within the ELCA, there is a tremendous number now of white ministers who are trying to lead the charge in the arena of civil rights as a human equality issue, not just a religious issue. It is a religious issue. But it is more than that for our society. And so seeing not just black ministers, but other ministers involved in trying to get people to see things differently. And then for me, the other part is to see I can't tell you how, I know people hate this, but I'm a 24-year military veteran. I served in Vietnam. Colin Kaepernick was really important to me. Not as I have to watch myself here. My wife will be mad at me. I get so angry because I think people don't. We keep finding the simple thing that bothers us about it and miss the point. And so when we all raise Cain about the flag or the anthem, we miss the point. It never, ever was about that. So figure out what the point was. And so for people in our society...
You're going to have to tell us what the point was. Colin Kaepernick, what was the point?
The point was, people, there's an inequality in our society. You need to start seeing it and address it. That's the point. It had nothing to do with disrespect to the troops. One of my favorite movies, I'll challenge you guys here and I'll challenge the listeners. One of my favorite movies is a movie called The American President. And he spends the whole time not wanting to get into a character debate until like the last 2 minutes of the movie. And then he comes before the press and makes this huge presentation. And one of the most important parts of that is, if you want a free society, then you have to understand freedom is the right of somebody to burn the flag of your country. That's freedom. And if you're not willing to allow that freedom, then you do not have a free society. And so thinking about that and focusing on, forget, don't look at the obvious. Look deep and see what's really being talked about. That's my concern. But I'm excited because I'm seeing other folks starting to speak up. And how many people came to the defense of Colin when everybody said, you're disrespecting the flag or you're disrespecting the anthem, and then other people got involved? We haven't resolved that issue.
My memory of it initially was he was talking about police brutality against black men. Mm-hmm. And it's
an equality issue. Yeah. And look at, if you want to talk black equality, look at our prisons. Is it really our society that the blacks are so bad that they all need to be in prison? But, look at what happens to if you're black, you get the book thrown at you. If you're white, we don't want to ruin your opportunity, so nothing happens to you.
Like those white swimmers.
Yeah.
What do you think, Todd?
Your question is, do religious leaders make us better or make us worse
off?
Well,
I was kind of like referring to these particular black religious leaders, Malcolm X included in that batch.
Well, we just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday, and what a great man he was. I mean, I can't quote him directly, but one of the most common things that is quoted from him is that we make ourselves better not through forcing other people to our views, but loving them and recognizing the value that they have within them. And that's why, I believe that's why his message was so universally seen and accepted. And you only have to look and see where our nation was 50 years before Martin Luther King and see where it was in those years where we grew up. Dramatic improvement. Martin Luther King was a fabulous man with the ability to self-sacrifice himself to elevate all of us. And he recognized you can only do that, that you don't do that through force or coercion by any means. You do that through love and recognizing the value that we have as human beings and sons and daughters of a God.
Do you see any negative results that came from that, from those ministers getting involved in civil rights in the way they did? We've all talked about the positives so far. Is there anything that happened regarding their involvement that you could say was negative?
His death was a tragedy. I would say that was the biggest negative that was involved with that. But our nation progressed dramatically because of Martin Luther King and the values that he espoused. And we would all do well to remember him and the things that he represented and the message that he taught on tolerance and recognizing that we each have value and it's not determined by the pigment of our skin.
But I love what you said. Thanks, Todd. But I do think that there, you know, just as we said somewhere earlier in the conversation, I think it might have been Gray who said it, that there's different kinds of zealots, so to speak, in every angle. And so I'm not going to say that some of the black ministers in those early years maybe were not a little too pushy or maybe not really on the right message as Martin Luther King was. They're in the right direction but just veering a little bit off of track there, and so it created more of a barrier for other folks. I get along with Martin Luther King, I see that, but this guy over here, I just don't understand that. It's not really the same message. It's close, but not the same message.
Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson weren't nearly as effective as
that's right.
As Martin
and
Luther
so,
King.
You know, no and you know, but we all have our facts or whatever to drive home, but sometimes they're not the right ones either.
You look at any of the great religious figures of our time, Mother Teresa is one. She focused on the individual. She focused on what can I do to help that individual. There was no self-servitude in anything she did. Martin Luther King was much the same. He was willing to go to jail and to espouse those virtues that we should love one another and recognize his dream. You look at I'm blanking on his name. Give me a minute here. I'll remember it.
Is it Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson?
No, I was thinking
some good person.
Billy Graham.
Okay.
Look at Billy Graham. Is our society better because of those three individuals, or are we worse off because of them? All three of those come from very diverse backgrounds, but all had the same message, that we are sons and daughters of a Father in heaven, and And we should look at that as the underlying thing, that we all have values no matter where we come from. And they come from three diverse different backgrounds.
Yep. Anything negative, Greg?
You know, I'm struggling to define anything negative because, like you said, the death of Dr. Martin Luther King was a greatest tragedy. In respect to Malcolm X, I think many people are familiar with his life story. And so, of course, he was a very radical and very critical of Dr. King in the beginning. But after he was expelled from the Nation of Islam, which was the Black Muslim movement, but he traveled to the Holy Land in Mecca, and he met Muslims of all races.
A lot of whites.
Yeah, a lot of white Muslims there, yes. Or Asian, all races of Muslim and African Muslims. And so that really opened his eyes to see that Islam was for all people. And so when he came back, I think he tried to reach out to Dr. King. But, you know...
Actually, towards the end, they became very close.
Before he was killed.
Right,
before he was killed. So that was another tragedy. And I think it's hard to really think of anything bad that came from it. I think that, you know, we have to remember those lessons of 50 years ago and push forward to, because they say that there are some people who want to take us back. 50 years and all of the progress that we've made with voting rights and equality and civil rights, there are some who want to go back. And I think the forum that we're having here now, right here in the Matsu Valley, is excellent effort to keep the spirit going.
What is your assessment of the support or lack of support that Donald Trump received from the evangelical community? Have you thought about that at all? About people from the evangelical community voted for Trump. Some decided not to vote for Trump. What's your assessment of that?
Donald Trump is a president that has shown conservative values to Christians, which has been barren in Washington, D.C. for a number of years now. And so for a man who's willing to say Merry Christmas, for a man who's willing to admit that he prays, those were refreshing things to people that have religious values, whether from Christianity or from Islam. And I think that's why he garnered support. Is he a perfect man? No. Am I? No. Is anybody in this room? No.
No.
He has the same flaws that we all do. He's willing to express his beliefs.
What beliefs is he expressing?
Well, he's expressed his willingness to follow the Constitution of the United States. I think that's probably one of the things that's most appealing to him. He's expressed his views that he is a strong constitutionalist. He is someone who recognizes the value of life that I think most religious people will strongly get behind that, that life is something that's sacred and divine. And I think that's probably one of the things that appeal to most people. Because for years and years, I don't think that we've had somebody there that that expresses those views and acts on those views. So I think that's why some of his views have been accepted, and he received a lot of votes from conservative people, religious people, because of those.
Everybody agree with that?
Well, I think, President Bush, it was President W. Bush.
Jimmy Carter. Mike just passed me a note about Jimmy Carter. Yeah. Kind of like being the first one there.
Yeah. But I think President Bush and President Obama all, I think they acknowledged and expressed Merry Christmas and had Christmas celebration with their families and everything. I don't think that was necessarily missing through the for the past few years. Of course, like you said, maybe not as conservative as President Trump is now, but I think people, like you said, I agree with Todd that people do aspire to have some faithful leadership, and I think they're still looking for that. One good thing I will say is that our system of checks and balances has really come out well in this past year, so that, you know, the judicial system and the legislature and everybody is sort of keeping each other in the right direction. That's one thing I will say. I'm really happy to see that.
Good to see the three branches of government at work.
That's right, yeah.
Ron?
I'm thinking I want to pass on this one. you know, for me, it's pretty simple, and I have had many of these conversations with some very dear longtime friends. But as I kind of said earlier, for me, it's less about what you say. It's more about what you do. And there was a time in my life when I was very, very, very conservative, and these friends are still around and we still talk, and I challenge them all the time because I've come to believe that it's less about what I say and more about what I do. And to say I'm saved, for the conservative element, somebody says I'm saved, that's cat's meow, you're saved. But, you know, the Bible also says that when you're saved, there should be some resulting works or proof. And I'm just not seeing that. I'm not seeing it in the way we can say it in simple terms of, well, we're returning to the Constitution, or we're saying Merry Christmas. That really isn't. First of all, the Constitution and the church are supposed to be somehow separate. And for a very good reason that we talked about earlier, and
First
we
Amendment,
started with
freedom,
you know,
of religion.
We started right off with the question about state-directed church, and you know, that's the whole reason that that's in our Constitution. And for many of my conservative friends, there's an element that the United States is the new Israel. That we are God's blessed country, and so all of this is coming to be, and we need to recognize. Well, yeah,
I want to.
We're
get
just
back.
A country.
Get back to something.
I think one.
Can I ask you a question before
sure.
you go there? You talked about Mr. Trump as a man of faith. Did I get that right?
I think that the reason why President Trump received such a large voting bloc by the religious community was because of his belief that life starts at conception, and that he was going to vote and elect Supreme Court justices that would uphold that.
So it was more the abortion issue.
I truly believe that's mm-hmm. probably the number one thing why he received so much support from religious figures.
Okay. I'm sorry I interrupted you. So you were going to comment on what Ron said earlier?
So that's what I was going to say.
Okay.
Is that I think that's where he garnered so much support, and he carried that out. He elected a Judge Gorsuch, who's a constitutionalist, who has those same conservative religious beliefs, and he carries himself in that manner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to move on to a slightly different road here. Religious organizations exist in the secular world. Okay, we have our churches. They're on the ground. That ground is in the United States of America. Employees of churches and religiously affiliated educational institutions get paid wages. The employees get paid the wages. They pay taxes to the government. It's called income tax. While their employers are tax exempt. Is there anything wrong with that, where the employees are paying taxes, but the churches themselves are tax exempt? Any comment on that? You think that's a fair system, or do you think that needs to be changed?
You're going to have to reword that. I'm not following what you're asking.
Well, I'm saying that the churches and the largest landowner in probably the largest, the most expensive real estate, Manhattan Island in New York, is the Roman Catholic Church. Yep. They pay no taxes, no property taxes. They pay no income taxes. My question is it fair for the employees of these religious organizations to have to pay taxes and the employers have tax-exempt status? Do you think that's okay? And it's okay if you believe it's okay. I'm just asking the question here.
I personally never thought of it.
never gave it any thought.
I'm not sure I have an opinion on it. Again, that comes down to something that if that was a real hot button issue, that could be brought up by our representatives, and they could change that law at any moment.
It's not a hot button issue. It's just something I thought about.
I really don't think that it is a hot button issue, because if it was, I think our government would be more than happy to increase taxes in any way they could.
Yeah. I think the biggest hot button about it is the church property being used for religious purposes? That would be one way to think about it. On the other hand, you know, it's an odd question, but let's back into it from a different direction. How much time? Okay. It'll take me that long to even think this out.
Oh, you just go ahead right on.
If part of the rationale, as I understand it in my studies, of the kind of the concept of the First Amendment with the separation of church and state really goes back to the state in England and Germany and stuff. They had directed, this is our state religion, and taxes were collected and went to those organizations to operate them. Do I think that's right? Absolutely not. So in a sense, by not taxing religious organizations on their property or their income, is the state not supporting them? The only thing you could say that's different here is it's there for everybody, every religion. It's not, well, you 99 religions have to pay taxes, but this one over here doesn't have to, because that's our state religion. So there is a slight difference there, but in a way, not paying taxes, our government is supporting religion.
Okay. What do you think about that, Greg?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough question. The thing that comes to my mind is along the lines of church organizations becoming politically active. I think that's a big question that comes to my mind. And, you know, they're taking that tax-exempt status, and they're not supposed to be – there's supposed to be some more restrictions on their political activity. So I think that's
the thing. If you think religions are getting tax-exempt status, they should not engage in political activism. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we got about a minute here, so go ahead, Todd.
I think tax-exempt status goes far beyond religious things. You can religion is just one example of a 501(c). You can think of the hospitals that are 501(c)s, that are charitable hospitals. You can think of health foundations. You can think of colleges across the nation. You can think of such as the Matsu Health Foundation, which is a 501(c). The common thread that those things have is the betterment of us, mm-hmm. betterment of our kids, mm-hmm. And to do that in an apolitical way. And that's kind of where our government has said, if you cross this line, if you're preaching from the pulpit or you're preaching from the operating room or you're preaching from the school podium politics, trying to sway one way or the other, you no longer qualify for the 501(c) status.
So, Greg, we have about 30 seconds. Any final comments on today's topic?
Politics and religion. Well, can I say something about my, okay. Well, yeah, I think that, actually, one final word I would say, I stand firmly on the separation of church and state.
Ron, you got 5 seconds.
5 seconds. Well, the thought of employees versus the organization, with hospitals, there is all kinds of mentions of places where they don't pay taxes on their property, but employees. So I think that's two different issues. And I really like what you said, Todd, about...
Thank you all. Ron Rucker, Greg Jones, Todd Pace. Very passionate discussion on very real political and religious issues. Thanks so much. This is Bridging the Gap. See you next time. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.